because that was viewed in a certain fashion. And if you tried to adapt to what were seen to be more popular things, you were somehow seen as selling your soul. But if you didn't do that, you left the field open to the Democrat to do the same thing.
Right.
So it was frustrating.
Welcome to the Arkansas Times podcast, The Conversation. This is Matt Price. Today we have a special guest, Max Brantley of the Arkansas Times, with us today. And we wanted to revisit a story that's been recounted many, many times, but I think, myself included, maybe don't have a good idea of the broad strokes of how the Arkansas newspaper wars between the Arkansas Democrat and the Arkansas Gazette took place. And Max had a front row seat, so I kind of wanted to talk to you about that today, Max, and get some juicy stories and some the real tactical sides of it. But first, before we kind of dive into that, I wanted to give listeners an overview of kind of what I see the timeline as, so people can have a good point of reference for when did this start, what were the different phases, and then this is the ending. So really, this starts back in 1974 when the Arkansas Democrat, which was an afternoon paper, was sold to Waco, which is Walter Hussman's company. Waco had been an owner of some South Arkansas newspapers. They were in the publishing industry.
Very, very successful, by the way, which is an important point.
Right.
I mean, there were papers in Camden, Texarkana, El Dorado, Hot Springs, and they also owned cable TV franchises. I think he was often depicted as the little guy, and actually he wasn't so little.
Right. Yeah, so Walter came in to the Little Rock market in 1974 with the purchase of the Arkansas Democrat. They, for the first few years, worked on cutting costs. I think they ended the union in the newsroom as well. But they weren't able to really grow against the much more robust Arkansas Gazette at the time. And so there were several attempted joint operating agreements that Walter proposed to the Gazette that didn't ever quite work out, and it was an attempt to create a joint operating company.
Right. They had a law then that said newspapers could get around antitrust laws by saying this voice will leave the community if it goes out of business. And so companies could combine, they could agree to share profits. The interesting thing, of course, is that's all past us now. The publishing industry has changed so much.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about antitrust laws.
Everybody's struggling to survive now.
Yeah, exactly.
Even a monopoly newspaper.
Right, right. So after those joint operating agreements didn't really come to pass, the Democrat went to a morning paper to compete head-on with the Arkansas Gazette. They hired a new editor who he was quoted as saying, put the paper on a wartime footing. John Robert Starr in 1979. He's a bit of a controversial figure. At that point in 1979, the Arkansas Gazette still had almost double the circulation as the Democrat. So it was still very much the Democrat was the underdog, and they were coming at it as the little guy. One of the interesting things about Starr is he had a daily opinion piece. They increased the newsroom, the journalist staff, by almost a factor of two over his tenure in those early days, and that did start to grow their readership. And in this time period, Max, you were at the Gazette. What was your role in the early 80s?
Well, at that point, I was an assistant city editor, so I was one of the people that supervised the city reporting staff. I was just a line editor. But I was, of course, intensely interested in what was going to happen. And in the very beginning, I think there were old Gazette hands that sneered at the Democrat. I was not one of those because, as I've said, particularly when they went morning, they made a huge investment in the newspaper. Starr, indeed, got a lot of attention for both running the news staff and writing an opinion column. They increased their staff, and they made a vow that we'd print more pages, they would print more pages every day than the Arkansas Gazette printed. More is more. And they also made two key decisions. One was they gave away classified advertising, unheard of. That's a franchise profit center for most newspapers. Hussman was encouraged by a publisher in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to try this, and it turned out to be fabulously successful. Every ad wasn't free, but private party ads were. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a reader thing. People would pick up the paper to see the free want ads. and it made some money for them. They also began giving the paper away. They gave it away one day a week for free, threw it everywhere in the county. And also I came to find out, and this also ended up being true with the Gazette too in the Gannett years, was if you subscribed to the paper, it was just about impossible to cancel it. You said, I'm through paying for it. I don't want any more. I said, well, we're going to keep bringing it to you.
Right.
I subscribed for 4 years without ever paying for it just to test how serious they were about paying. They wanted the numbers, and they got the numbers. And as I say, I think the Gazette in the last years participated in some circulation inflating stuff too. So the war was serious, and the reporting staffs were serious about their reporting. The city editor of the Gazette at that time was a famous journalism figure named Bill Shelton, and he very closely looked at the stories they had that we didn't have and why we didn't have them, and we were intent on beating the competition, and so were they. I think we were a little more bound by convention than they were in how we approached stories. I don't want to say sensational is too strong a word for them, but they were looking for ways to get attention, and our hands were somewhat tied. One of the first things they did was introduce color photography, and they put color on page one. Frequently, a fire engine or a fire was very popular because of the red color that would attract people to the newsstand. Well, we were very late to the color photography game at the Gazette, and when we did, people said, well, we were tarting up the old lady by having color, whereas people like the color photography in the Democrat, we weren't supposed to do that sort of tarting.
You guys were the old gray lady, right?
Yeah. So,
at what point did the newsroom realize that this was going to be a real competition, that they were really gunning for
well,
you guys' position?
Well, it was evident early on, because first of all, the Star used his column to sometimes personally attack people who worked at the Gazette. And he kind of used a very familiar political tactic, which is you run against the strengths of somebody. You identify a strength and you run against it. One of his favorite targets was Orville Henry, the legendary sports writer and who had helped the Gazette survive the desegregation crisis with his Razorback coverage. And he couldn't stop writing about what a sorry homer and loser and terrible person Orville Henry was. Of course, eventually they would hire him
away.
Right. But they tried to tear down things that were perceived as strengths. They, of course, attacked the liberal editorial policy of the Arkansas Gazette, which was certainly true, and it was somewhat at variance in some ways with Arkansas, although you have to remember at that time this was a state that had that would go to elect a string of progressive governors, David Pryor, Dale Bumpers, Jim Guy Tucker, and Bill Clinton. And so we were a populist state, certainly socially conservative, but the editorial page wasn't necessarily out of step with the people all of the time.
Right. So I'm also curious, kind of from a business standpoint, at what point did the corporate people in the Gazette start trickling down into the editorial in terms of they were feeling the pinch?
You know, I think the Patterson family, which owned the paper, was pretty good about not transferring their problems to the news staff until they did announce eventually Hugh would talk to the newsroom about turning down the joint operating agreement and why he did. And a lot of people thought that was a terrible decision, but he and his family have always said that the outcome would have been bad, that they couldn't survive. And this goes, again, to the situation that led to the antitrust suit, and I think is often overlooked in the histories of the paper. The Pattersons had enjoyed a long run of a very profitable newspaper at the Gazette. But apart from owning a little bit of real estate in a low-rent section of downtown Little Rock, their only property was the Arkansas Gazette. They didn't have other resources to tap into for money. And Walter Hussman did. And in fact, I think he's been quoted as saying, if more or less, that he tried to operate where his profits off the rest of his media enterprises were sufficient to cover the losses at the Arkansas Democrat during those years. And it was during the big newspaper war, the Gannett versus Hussman time, when the losses mounted, that he said it came very close to him to make the decision to quit because it was starting to cut into bone on the other operations. And indeed, people who worked for his other properties talked about how what had once been profitable profit-sharing plans were not paying like they once had because the company was putting money into the Democrat operation in Little Rock
And at this time, yeah, and at this time, the publishing industry was an extraordinarily profitable industry to be in.
Oh, sure. There was big money to be made, but the Gazette could see the writing on the wall, and that's why they filed the antitrust suit. I mean, the Hussman was giving away advertising below cost. He was giving away his newspaper. He was vowing to print more pages than the Gazette. And from a strictly business point of view, Hugh Patterson realized he couldn't sustain that kind of competition forever. It's like, as a friend of mine once said, if you own a service station and a guy on the service station across the street and said, whatever you sell your gas for, I'm going to sell it for a dime cheaper. and I'm a millionaire and I'll do it forever.
Right.
And so he did. But the Gazette lost the antitrust suit. That's been endlessly gamed for whether we had the right lawyer for the case. And Hugh Patterson, right, the publisher, took a very big bonus out of the company the last year before the suit was filed,
sure,
which was used against him in court, and it was a jury trial. And anyway, they won. And then when they won, Hugh Patterson knew the writing was on the wall. He couldn't sustain that level of competition without any resources unless he would just borrow himself into bankruptcy. And so he sold the newspaper.
Yeah, and that's where another transition happens when Gannett purchases the paper from Hugh Patterson and the high school family. Do you think in this part before the paper sells to Gannett, was it a failure of Patterson's ability to innovate? Was it a misunderstanding of the competition?
A combination of things. Certainly by the end, I don't think anybody misunderstood Walter Hussman's zeal and his commitment and his willingness to spend money. I mean, you'd had to have been blind not to see that. And were there steps? There are people that say, I think Carrick Patterson, Hugh Patterson's son to this day, says perhaps if he'd been free, there are things he might have done differently. But I just don't know. You know, we competed vigorously. Having seen what I've seen happen in the newspaper industry, I don't think you could have added 100 reporters, and that necessarily would have changed the balance sheet anyway, except to make it bleed more red ink. Perhaps we could have changed fundamentally who we were, editorial and in other ways. I don't know. There might have been tactics and advertising. I just don't know. I just think ultimately, though, it boiled down to a very simple thing, which was a deeper pocketed person who was playing a heck of a game of poker and refused to flinch,
mm-hmm,
and kept anteing up.
Right.
And invested in some, I mean, staff, pages, broad range of editorial services. I don't mean to say it was all done with smoke and mirrors. I mean,
right,
he made an investment in the product.
In quality journalism. Yeah. And then, it, you know, looking at it from a market size standpoint, by 1991, the total number of people that subscribed to the paper either won. The market had grown substantially.
Yeah, well, it was crazy. I don't know. The numbers are so bogus, really, in retrospect. But the combined circulation of the two Sunday papers in 1991, when the war, mm-hmm, came to an end, was 450,000.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, close to half a million. Yeah.
Now, a lot of those were double people, of course. Well, today, I think the Sunday circulation of the Democrat Gazette, with a growing population and a huge incursion by them in Northwest Arkansas, I think is under 200,000,
yeah,
now. And their circulation in the city, and this is not their fault as much as a sign of the changing times, but I saw their city's own circulation figures the other day, and they used to brag about how they touched 80-90% of the homes in Little Rock on a Sunday paper. It's dropped substantially, mm-hmm, from where, tens of thousands from where it was. Of course, so is their staff. They once had a 250-person
right,
news staff, and it's now down to about 100.
Right.
And they're doing better than, again, I want to say I'm not throwing down on them. The Denver Post in a city which, mm-hmm, is four times our size now has a news staff of 70 people.
Right, so, right. Yeah, they've continually tracked better than the industry,
yeah,
average.
I think he's still making a bigger investment in what a newspaper is supposed to be, mm-hmm, about than a lot of bigger papers are.
Right, right. So kind of back to the timeline, after the antitrust lawsuit was filed and the Gazette lost, the jury ruled in favor of the Democrat, they sold it to Gannett. So what was the change at that point in the newsroom? How did you guys perceive that?
Well, I think in our hearts we'd have preferred to remain a family-owned operation. And there was some fear and that they would bring changes that we wouldn't always like. And, of course, that turned out to be true. But they came in and, you know, Al Newharth, who was head of what was then the biggest newspaper corporation in the country, flew in on his private jet and took a limousine from the Capitol Hotel to the Gazette one block away and had a news conference and had an appearance in the newsroom in which he said they were prepared to make whatever investment was necessary to win. And we knew we'd lost our previous ownership because of lack of money, and so they clearly could bring some money to the table. And very shortly, they spent a lot of money. And over 5 years, spent a huge sum of money.
Yeah.
And they didn't win.
Right. Well, I think there's another – KUAR did another piece. If you want to hear a longer, more in-depth coverage of this, there's multiple pieces out there, but KUAR does a really good one where they're talking to Walter. And Walter was looking at the balance sheets and the P&Ls right after the closure.
Right, he got to look at the books.
Yeah, and it was amazing the amount of losses that Gannett was suffering just year over year.
They were the same for him, by the way. At the time of the antitrust case, the estimate was on loss value of money he'd invested plus what he'd spent was over $100 million. I think an easy estimate of what Walter Hussman lost in terms of buying newspapers and the losses over the years, over $200 million. But then he had a monopoly at the end, and in the next 10 years or so, for sure, that was a very profitable enterprise. But then the world changed. But in any event, during the Gannett war years, the money spent, there was no amount that was too much to spend. I mean, I flew all over the country covering things, and I can't ever remember anybody saying we need this and somebody saying no, we can't afford it.
Flying Scott Pruitt style.
Yeah. Well, I didn't fly in private jets, but you know, but I got to follow Bill Clinton to Los Angeles and Des Moines during the beginnings of his presidential campaign, and it was an amazing time. We had, I can't remember how many state bureaus did we have? 7.
Wow.
I mean, we had an office and a person in Fort Smith, Fayetteville, Jonesboro, Searcy, Pine Bluff. We had about a 12-person photography staff. I was trying to remember the other day, as an assistant managing editor, I was in charge of the reporting staffs of the state, city, and business departments. And that doesn't count feature reporters and sports reporters, but there must have been 50 or 60 of them. And that didn't count the copy desk, which was... They used to have copy desks. They don't have many copy editors anymore these days. They're considered too expensive, and they've gone away. But we had assistant editors and assistant managing editors out the wazoo. And so it was, I think, one of the best examples of an expenditure. And this was really an amazing thing. At the end of the Gannett War, they said, they're just not going to beat us on anything. More is going to be more, and we're going to have more. And the last regular session of the legislature before the war ended, this would have been in January of 91, that winter, we put out an 8-page tabloid section every day of the legislature, solely on the legislature.
Wow.
I wrote for it, Bob Lancaster wrote for it, Ernie Dumas wrote for it, and we were just opinion writers. Then we had a full staff of at least 5 reporters. A photographer was assigned there every day. An editor was assigned to edit the copy. I mean, there wasn't a leaf that fell that wasn't marked by this incredible effort just on covering the legislature. And we had a full staff of people covering everything else in the city and state as well.
Right. Take me back to those days when it wasn't clear what the outcome was going to be after Gannett made the purchase.
Well, first of all, I mean, there were changes in culture. Gannett said they didn't want to necessarily mess with local leadership, but they sent in a team of people of their top people from their papers around the country to assess the paper, and they reported back to headquarters on what they found to be strengths and weaknesses. One of the first casualties was Carrick Patterson, the son of Hugh Patterson, who was the in charge of editorials and was executive editor, I guess was the title. And I hate to characterize exactly how it came to pass, but his time ended as executive editor. I mean, he resisted, understandably, some of the things the Gannett people said. They sent in a guy who Michael Gartner, who went on to be head of news for NBC, but he was with Gannett at the time. He'd been at the Des Moines Register, and he wrote a memo about how, just terribly boring and dull and kind of official news-oriented we were in coverage, and we really needed to do different things. And that really offended, I think, Carrick and everybody who read the memo, really. And it was kind of a template for some of the changes that were eventually made. One of the great ironies was after Gartner left Gannett, he went home to Iowa and bought a small-town paper in Iowa City, later won the Pulitzer Prize, in part because what great coverage they did of the local planning commission. And those were exactly the sorts of things that he said this Gazette fixation on official coverage was just a terrible thing, whereas we thought that's kind of what you did.
What
you're supposed to do. So that was a funny note. But in any event, there were cultural changes. They brought in some new people. They brought in a new managing editor in time, and Walker Lundy, who had a famous period that finally got so bad they moved him out and brought in somebody else, Keith Moyer. There was certainly a big push to do more in sports, to do more in features coverage, to do more. And the thought was that what people want is sports and TV. I mean, as a representation of the cultural wishes, I'm not sure they were wrong about that. But again, this brought a change in the appearance of something that, I mean, it was kind of unfair, but it was real. I mean, the Gazette was viewed in a certain fashion, and if you tried to adapt to what were seen to be more popular things, you were somehow seen as selling your soul. But if you didn't do that, you left the field open to the Democrat to do the same thing.
Right.
So it was frustrating.
Yeah, there was too much. The consumers had too much brand identity with kind of your old brand.
Yeah, right.
And you guys weren't able to really.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard to break out of that. But we went to color comics, three pages. Somebody had to sit in every day and paint the comic pages so they'd be in color. Just sort of amazing.
Oh, wow.
Investments in things. The features department became huge. We spent a lot of time designing and redesigning the TV book to get the best Sunday TV magazine. That was thought
horizontal versus vertical,
right there, yeah. Which was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But that was thought where you won newspaper wars was with your TV. I think it's true. A lot of people buy the Sunday paper to get the TV schedules. Of course, think how much that's changed.
Right.
I mean,
and the part that's so hard for I'm younger, but old enough to remember the last days of the newspaper wars and remember. You know, getting a daily newspaper when I was a kid, and, you know, I subscribed later in life, but there was a long period where I didn't, is just how, just from a, you know, a 50,000-foot view, these are two, and this is before Gannett bought it, two Arkansas companies that are large Arkansas companies, you know, with revenue lines in the tens of millions,
right,
that are going head-to-head against each other in a solely Arkansas market. That just doesn't exist anymore.
No, it was. I think probably the last. There were some battles that continued. Denver was one place, but it was one of the really great last dog eat dog newspaper wars.
Right.
I think.
Well, and even outside of the publishing industry, I mean, I think that's also what's so interesting is that you don't have companies, local companies in Arkansas this size that are solely Arkansas companies going after Arkansas customers like that, and I think that's a really It's really interesting. It's
right, and going after them in places, it's again interesting today. We were fighting for customers in Newton County, Arkansas,
right.
You know, up at Ponca and Boxley and just far removed places. And now, today, Walter Husband started an experiment in Mississippi County, which will grow if it works, which is to give people an iPad so they can get the paper by the internet. So they don't have to deliver it anymore.
Of course,
in 91, when the paper ended, I guess there probably was something called an internet, but essentially the internet didn't exist. And then in a very short period of time, really, the internet did exist.
Yeah.
And suddenly people, when they woke up, less so in the mid-90s than today, but when you wake up in the morning, when the paper hits your door, there's so many mornings, and no offense to the Democrat, because they got to go to press at some time and print the paper and put it in trucks and deliver it.
Right.
That a big story has developed after they went to press. And the headline You know, the Austin bombing guy, I mean, that story developed right. overnight. I mean, it's, and by the time they hit there, their story's out of date. Mm-hmm. It's now they're online and they're keeping up there, but,
right.
but we're just struggling with the dislocation.
Having gone through that and then, you know, being part of the Arkansas Times and evolving the way the Times has, obviously nothing to the scale of what the newspaper wars were like in the 80s. Here could happen again, but you know, what do you think the local news landscape looks like? Not just from legacy players, but from new people.
It's troubled in Arkansas because we're a poor place, and we're lucky that the Democrat Gazette exists as it exists today. It's still a good conventional newspaper that's attempting to broadly cover the city and the state. And invest in a pretty fair amount of money in doing so, even though they've had setbacks and staff cuts and all the rest. But they're it. There are a few daily papers around the state owned by some other companies that are doing okay. Mm-hmm. But in the capital city, there's not much.
Right.
Arkansas Business does a great job covering business, and they're mm-hmm. pretty vibrant. We struggle. Every year is a struggle for us to come out in the black. And it's, you know, I think our future is going to have to be digital too, eventually. Mm-hmm. And just who steps up to fill these holes is a big question. In Texas, they've had incredible luck with something called the Texas Tribune. It's a nonprofit organization, and they've raised a ton of money from public-spirited Texans that's supporting a really old-fashioned and good reporting enterprise. But, I mean, that's, I don't think American journalism as a whole can follow a nonprofit model. There'll be pockets of places, they're trying this in Philadelphia too, where there are enough rich people who can sustain a real news gathering operation. A lot of our web enterprises today that are really good are currently just hedge fund plays. They're not making, I mean, there are any mm-hmm. number of them. Salon is one, the liberal vent that I write, but they're not making any money.
Right.
Some people have decided to invest in them for a while, and whether it's to build up something that's worth something as a digital thing sometime down the line, I don't know. But the New York Times has been successful with a subscription model to its digital edition, but they're one of but a very few that have been able to do this. And so I just think it's just uncertain, especially in smaller markets where they're just not, because there is no advertising. Facebook and Google and Amazon have thoroughly dislocated the advertising market. The ad dollars are
duopoly,
just, they're just not there.
Right.
And how you know, we run into it all the time. We have a limited subscription thing at the Arkansas Times for our blog, and it makes some money. And it's mostly, I think, we appeal to people. It's almost philanthropic. I mean, I think there are X number of people that say, gosh, I got to read it. I don't want to hit the paywall. But
this is probably a good time for a plug, too. If you're not already a digital subscriber, you should go ahead and subscribe.
$10 a month. But I think it's also just an investment in keeping an alternative voice alive. Obviously, we have a very different editorial outlook than the Democratic right. Gazette does, for example. And we do some different projects than they do. And so that's partly how we get there. But, you know, the money, it's just hard to say. And others out there starting up, I don't know how they do it. And then there's always a problem when it is a philanthropic underwriter. So suppose the Waltons decided to invest in sustaining a journalistic voice in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Given some of their political practices, I mean, I think they bring some suspicion to the table. I would be suspicious of any product wholly financed by the Waltons on education issues, just
right.
given what they're I mean, I'm not, for those of you who don't know, they have a view on school choice, so-called, that happens to be different from my own, mm-hmm. and they promote it pretty vigorously, and which is their right, and they're entitled to do, but I would expect to see it reflected in their newspaper if they had one, just as, in fact, it is in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, which has a similar ownership outlook.
Right. Talking about, you know, the Facebook-Google advertising duopoly, I mean, they own, I want to say, last figure I read was 75 cents of every dollar spent online right. goes to Google and Facebook. Is that a failure of the publishing industry? I mean, is that a real failure for publishers not understanding technology?
Well, it was in the beginning, certainly. I think an awful lot of print people were slow to give up that they thought print would always be here and that it would always produce a 30% margin.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy, were they wrong. we were never, as Arkansas Times as a weekly, never really susceptible to that. We started a digital effort way ahead of everybody here. We've had an online news blog here for 14 years mm-hmm. now. I mean, we were an early adopter on that. We were not an early adopter on making any money on it, but we were an early adopter. Although actually we had some success selling display advertising back when you could still sell display advertising on the web, which is now much harder to do. But no, I think people were slow, and then the web created a mindset that information has to be free, even when they don't understand that it's not free because they're getting all this targeted advertising in the ways that there's an awful lot of money flowing that the reader doesn't fully understand. Not to mention, we now know you're providing people with information that's being used in more nefarious ways, such as in political campaigns. No, I had somebody, I do a video every day and on Facebook. I mean, like everybody else, we've picked up all the things you can pick up. And what I find is, from the comments, is frequently people really don't, they see the headline on the Facebook item, but then they don't click through and read the article.
Mm-hmm.
They just make their tribal assumptions that I'm saying something about guns or about Trump and just take off from there. Right. But a lot of people do click through, and then I run into the people who say, well, what's this? I got to pay to see this? Well, number one, that means they've clicked it at least 10 times in a month because that's before the paywall comes. And then they suddenly say, then I got to pay. I said, well, you know, I'm not paid much, but I do get a salary.
Right.
And so does everybody else, and so does the guy who films it and puts the graphics together. And, you know, as I say, we don't have many people here, and they're not paid much, but it is a job.
Right.
Well, and so we got to get some money somewhere.
Yeah. And see, this is the way I kind of see this. It is a failure of the publishing industry to realize. And again, this is still very fluid. We're only, I mean, really probably 15 years into a transformational shift in the industry to understand that, you know, the way that newspapers used to work, where they would, you know, get so vertically integrated that they would own timber. They would actually own timber to print their paper on.
The paper company.
Right. So, I mean, there was a point where they understood, but now they haven't quite understood that the timber is no longer the timber.
No,
the new timber is understanding technology.
My depression stems from the fact that I'm 68 years old, and I've adapted as well as I can to technological things. I never thought I'd be using a digital camera and doing a podcast and doing Facebook Live and doing a blog and doing all the things I do, but I don't see now how you break up Facebook and Google. But there's somebody out there dreaming about the new dislocation, and maybe someday they'll dislocate them. I mean, I never thought you would beat Walmart when they got so big, but then Amazon is making them, well, they're not hurting,
I don't think.
But I mean, I think they've had to adapt, and they've had to close stores that used to be big profit centers. They're not anymore, and they're going into e-commerce and... So, you know, I don't want to predict the future because I'm not able to, but maybe there's something's coming. But I sit there today in the short term I've got left, and I just don't know what the answer is for newspapers. They're just all cratering everywhere.
Right. There's two things that I look at it in terms of local, very local news, you know, city, neighborhood, even local, that kind of give me a little bit of hope in two models that are kind of working, one being Nextdoor, which is not really even a news source per se as much as a neighborhood social network.
Right. Yeah.
And then Patch is another one.
Right, and that one kind of failed. That was kind of...
It's failed three times, but now it's more profitable than it's ever been.
Really?
Yes, and they're finding a lot of success in really large markets. They have, I believe it's either six or seven Patches in New York City. All of which are profitable.
Well, you know, New York City is still a place, it's densely populated. I just visited my son up there, and, you know, you walk through Brooklyn through we walked from the hotel to a restaurant, past about 12 blocks of little tiny restaurants mm-hmm. and retail establishments. And although I think they all have their digital, I could see where a neighborhood micro-targeted thing might have the ability to also have a sales component that would be useful to them. Could be.
Right.
I mean, but I look at Little Rock and it's hard because everybody who hadn't been put out of business by a chain store is,
which is another issue, right?
You know, they're trying to do their own web marketing.
Right.
And so we're getting into the agency business and doing web work and stuff too, like everybody else is. But, well, as I say, at the business end of it is not really my deal, but I'm skeptical.
Well, I think we can probably close out on that note. Max, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, sure.
Today.
Happy to do it.
Revisiting an old story, but one that I think is still very important.
I was supposed to tell the Great Blizzard of 1987 story, but
the one where they're delivering papers by four-wheeler.
Yeah, in the height of the newspaper war, and there was a 10-inch snowfall in Little Rock, and I got to work, and there were about three people there, and the publisher was fit to be tied because nobody had showed up because the snow was so deep. And furthermore, Walter Hussman's circulation department had rented every four-wheel drive in town to deliver their paper because getting the paper to the doorstop, that was the deal. And we got beat badly that day, and boy, he never let anybody who let down that day forget about it.
That's commitment right there.
Yeah, it was. I was there. I walked.
Right.
I walked early because, I mean, that's just what you did on snow day. You figured out a way to get there.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate you, Max.
Sure.
And catch us next week for the next episode of The Conversation.
Thanks, Matt.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.